tendencies, and while he harbored certain tightly held beliefs, he was no zealot. He was a quiet boy from a prominent Long Island family with a history of independent thinking that he had inherited. A peaceable man, he did his best to stay out of the war until an event forced him to take a stand. The Townsends of Oyster Bay. Like their Setauket neighbors, the Talmadges and the Woodhulls, the Townsends were a proud and ancient family by American standards. The fourth generation of Townsends born in America included Samuel Townsend, an outspoken and intrepid man, who in 1738, at the age of 21, had purchased 6 acres of land in the heart of Oyster Bay, near to the water and on the road to the mill. The property, which he christened the homestead, included a small house of practical design, 2 rooms built atop 2 other rooms, with a central chimney to distribute heat throughout. Over the next several years, Samuel hired local builders to expand the structure to a total of 8 rooms in the saltbox style. When the renovation and expansion were complete, he moved in, opened a general store, married a local girl. It was at the homestead that he and his wife Sarah began to cultivate both a fairly sizable orchard as well as a sizable family. There were 8 children in the 5th generation of Townsends, 4 sons, a daughter, another son, 2 more daughters. Samuel also acquired a fleet of 4 ships that traversed the Atlantic, east, north, south, which, in turn, kept his shop well-stocked and allowed him to trade in just about anything from fabric to rum, molasses, spices, sugar, and snuff. Besides his small fleet and well-provisioned shop, which was one of the most prominent in Oyster Bay, Samuel was also well-known for his political views, which were often at odds with those of the powers that be. In 1758, about halfway through the French-Indian War, he had fired off a strongly worded letter to the New York General Assembly on the subject of treatment of prisoners. Townsend found fault with the way enemy combatants were being sheltered and provided for by the colonial arm of the British Crown and wasted no words in informing them of such. He was arrested, brought before an assembly to justify his conduct of insulting them so openly. Several days under lock and key, and a stiff fine left him promising no further outbursts. A promise that lasted for a while, as the local schoolmaster noted in his journal. In the weeks following, Samuel has been as still as a mouse in a cheese. He took on the role of town clerk, and when talk of independence began to circulate, Samuel was generally considered one of those who favored a break with the crown, even though he seemed to consider himself middle of the road on the issue. His stances in politicking gradually got the better of him and landed him in hot water with the local authorities more than once. His children, in the meantime, were growing into successful adults, their business connections largely unsullied by their father's reputation as a rabble-rouser and a patriot. Odd man out. Solomon Townsend was, by all accounts, the consummate oldest son. He was just as eager a merchant as his father and, after a short apprenticeship, assumed the captaincy of one of his father's ships. After proving himself for several years with voyages to Canada, Portugal, and the Azores, he took over a European trading route on a 3-rigged ship for the Buchanan family, staunch loyalists related to the Townsends by marriage. The second son, Samuel Jr., began working in North Carolina as part of the flax trade, but died in 1773 at the age of 23 or 24, as the 3rd Townsend son, William, was employed elsewhere. When Samuel Jr. passed away, the 4th son, Robert, went south to briefly take his brother's place before returning to New York. Born on November 25, 1753, Robert was in many ways out of place in the Townsend family. As dark and lean as Solomon was broad and blonde, and as shy and reserved as William, nicknamed the flower of the family, was gallant and flirtatious. His desire was not for adventure or prestige, of a much more bookish disposition than his father or his brothers. He preferred to work quietly behind the scenes, managing the ledgers and accounts and inspecting incoming shipments, anything that kept him out of the limelight and the ribaldry that the other Townsend men shared with their sailors and clients. Not that Robert resented their quick wit and hearty laughter. In fact, he rather admired the spirit the rest of his family brought to life. But as the 4th son quickly followed by a long-awaited daughter, he had learned almost from infancy that he had no hope of being heard over his clamorous brothers or coddled as his mother's darling. So he separated himself by being the quiet one of such a rowdy bunch. Old Samuel probably wondered how Robert maintained subdued habits as he watched his young son with his loping gait stride past a rough-and-tumble wrestling match on the family front lawn. The Townsend family tree was peppered with Quakers. Though Samuel had married a daughter of prominent Episcopalians, which, along with his taste for luxury goods and the occasional bit of ostentatious accessorizing, put him largely on the outs with the friends among his relatives. But Robert seemed to have inherited all the Quaker tendencies of somber dress, quiet habit, and humble bearing that Samuel rejected, and they suited him well. Robert's nature made him fastidious and gave him an eye for detail, traits essential for success in the merchant trade. Still, Samuel thought to himself, the boy could use a little less rigidity in his life. There was likely no small source of amusement in the Townsend family when Samuel secured the terms of Robert's apprenticeship in Manhattan with Templeton and Stewart, a merchant house in the unfortunately named Holy Ground District, a disreputable part of town. The blocks around Barclay Church and Vesey Street were not more dangerous than any other slum in the city, but they were morally treacherous. The district's proximity to the docks meant it was prime real estate for both the profit-conscious merchants who wanted to be near their ships returning from voyages and for ladies of pleasure who wanted to be near randy sailors returning from months at sea. Surrounded by brothels, whores, and their clientele, straight-laced Robert distinguished himself at his work and navigated the seedy streets without a whiff of scandal about him in what was almost certainly a very lonely time for the young man. He marked the close of his teenage years in the firm's employment, dealing with almost every other commodity than the one being plied in the streets and cat houses around it. Choosing allegiances. Robert was not quite 22 when the first shots were fired at Lexington and Concord. For all his differences from the rest of his family, he shared something of his father's patriotic fervor. The battlefields in Massachusetts seemed far away, though, and many people expected the conflict to resolve itself before formal combat ever crossed the borders of New York State. By the following summer, however, it was clear that such assumptions were wrong. The Declaration of Independence was signed in July. War was moving inevitably closer to home, and all men of fighting age in the Mid-Atlantic region were forced to make the difficult decision of whether to enlist and on what side. On August 22, 1776, British troops began pouring onto Long Island, while the Americans hunkered down in their positions in Manhattan and in the area of Brooklyn, hoping to protect the mainland of New York City. The record of proceedings from the Provincial Congress for the State of New York show that on Saturday, August 24, 1776, among other motions adopted, was the unanimous resolution that Robert Townsend be a commissary to supply the brigade with provisions till such time as General Washington shall give further orders for that purpose. A footnote identifies the young man as the son of Samuel Townsend, the member for Queens County. According to the following morning's records, Samuel Sr. makes further recommendations for the purchasing process by which the newly appointed commissary should supply provisions to Brigadier General Nathaniel Woodhull and the Queens County Militia. So began Robert Townsend's whirlwind tenure in the Continental Army. Fighting broke out across Long Island and in Manhattan in the early morning hours of the 27th, just days after Robert's appointment had been confirmed. The Queens County militia guarding the ill-fated Jamaica Pass suffered greatly in battle. Their beloved Brigadier General Woodhull was mortally wounded. Robert's service did not last much beyond the Battle of Brooklyn, nor did his father's career as a leader for the Patriot cause on Long Island. Samuel was arrested in early September, though he avoided unpleasant imprisonment when Thomas Buchanan of the same family for which Solomon was working vouched for his character. A few days later, on September 10th, Samuel was called into court to swear his allegiance to the crown. He humbly complied and rather meekly returned to the homestead. By the end of 1776, nearly 1,300 other men from Queens County had taken the same vow of loyalty, though how many did so under duress is unknowable. Robert followed his father's example and took the distasteful pledge too. He left Oyster Bay soon afterwards and returned to his quiet life as a merchant in Manhattan, running a modest dry goods shop near the Fly Market in Lower Manhattan while the city cleaned up from the great fire that had ravaged it following the retreat of the Americans. New York was now solidly in British hands, but it mattered little to Robert. His unobtrusive personality and lack of any distinguishing battlefield heroics during his brief service were perhaps his greatest ally in allowing him to continue to work and prosper in the midst of the enemy. But every man has a breaking point, a moment when he has seen one atrocity too many, weathered one insult too many, stayed still for one day too long, and he knows he must act or hate himself for keeping silent. For Robert Townsend, that moment arrived in the fall of 1778, as Abraham Woodhull and his initial ring were beginning their intelligence war against the British in Manhattan and Long Island. The occupying armies were settling in quite comfortably in various private residences, including the Homestead, Robert Townsend's beloved home in Oyster Bay. Lieutenant Colonel John Simcoe, the man who had ordered the beating of Woodhull's father, decided that the Townsend family's house fit his purposes quite nicely and proceeded to set up his headquarters in the main part of the home, sequestering the family to just a few back rooms and the shop. At Simcoe's orders, British troops destroyed the orchard, of which old Samuel had been so proud, to feed British fires and help build a fort. Wood from all over town, including churches and private structures, were commandeered for this effort in a move that was very much in keeping with Simcoe's reputation as a heartless combatant. The town operated as if under martial law, with roughly 470 enemy soldiers quartering there, including Hessian brute squads that roamed the streets to make sure residents stayed indoors at night. There were public lashings for those who displeased the soldiers, and little recourse for those who brought complaints. The town was quickly descending into a simmering chaos, and any lingering loyalist feelings among the good people of Oyster Bay were rapidly evaporating. Old Samuel Townsend's history of outspoken political opinions was well known to the whole community, and likely the cause of the special treatment from the Queen's Rangers. That his house was one of the more comfortably situated and furnished dwellings in the town was a bonus. When Robert returned home in November 1778 to visit his family, he was no doubt shocked by his father's defeated appearance and posture. "What has happened to you, father?" Robert cried upon approaching the house. Samuel shook his head. "There are too many soldiers around to dare voice any dissatisfaction with the current state of things. I have been given the honor of playing host to His Majesty's troops," he said, somewhat shakily. "Who could have imagined our humble homestead would be put to such a purpose as this?" Tales of hardship and abuses, recounted in hushed tones and with sideways glances, seasoned Robert's meals during his time at home. He burned with anger as he learned of the wanton liberties taken with neighbors' properties and lives, but he could only stare in mute fury as he observed how the soldiers, including Colonel Simcoe himself, flirted openly with his sisters under their father's own roof. At the conclusion of his visit, Robert returns to his shop in Manhattan, but he is haunted by what he had seen. The crime, the squalor, these were the unfortunate accessories of city life, or so he had assumed. But now he had seen that Oyster Bay and countless other towns that dotted Long Island were not immune to the collateral damage of war. Rumors continued to reach him during the spring of atrocities committed by Simcoe and others against unarmed citizens, including the wounds inflicted upon old Richard Woodhull. And what could anyone do? The Townsend family stood as much chance of evicting Simcoe from their property as they did of expelling the whole enemy encampment from Long Island. There was no other option. They were in British-held territory. So the British laws stood, and protesters fell or hanged. The feelings of frustration and helplessness weighed heavily upon Robert. Each day, British soldiers and common New York citizens alike came into his shop to purchase everyday items such as buttons and paper. He knew he would do his family no favors if he took up arms against this army. They would only be labeled as having ties to a belligerent. Besides, Robert was not a fighting man, and his previous service had been focused on supply tents, not trenches. His soul was not the sort to be stirred by marching feet, keeping time to a fife tune and a drumbeat. Robert admired the way his older brother Solomon had found his way to steer his allegiances. Still sailing for the loyalist Buchanan family, in 1777, Solomon had carried supplies for the British Army to Montreal ahead of the invasion of northern New York. But in the spring of 1778, roughly 8 months before Simcoe had commandeered the family home for his own uses, Solomon had made a calculated move. He left his employment with the Buchanans and had managed to visit with none other than Benjamin Franklin in France, obtaining a letter from Franklin and vouching for his patriotism and fidelity to the American cause. Solomon then boarded an American warship and traveled across the Atlantic to relaunch his career at home, sailing and trading under the protection of the Continental Army and supplying its troops with much-needed provisions. Robert, meanwhile, was left shaken by his visit home later that fall and felt the weight of inaction as he walked the streets of occupied New York under the British flag and did business with His Majesty's troops for such trifles as ribbons and sugar. Despite his internal struggles in the months following his return to Manhattan from his trip home to Oyster Bay, Townsend was almost certainly surprised and was not easily won over when Woodhull made his proposal to work as a spy just as a hot, dusty summer was beginning in 1779. He was debating his own role in the struggle for independence. That much was true. But he was not like his brother, so brashly fearless and ready for any adventure. He was Robert. He was the quiet one, some might even say the timid one, of the Townsend boys. His was the name all the relations and neighbors forgot when speaking of his family. And he was perfectly content that things stay that way. Culper Jr. It is possible that the notion of spying had already crossed Robert Townsend's mind before Abraham Woodhull darkened the door of his shop in the late spring of 1779. It may have already been clear to Townsend that he was privy to scraps of conversation between soldiers in his own shop, to noting the flow of supplies and men into and out of the harbor as he inspected his own shipments on the docks, to observing the habits and patterns of the higher-ranking officers who graced James Rivington's posh new coffee house just down the street. It must have been clear to Townsend that his position in the city gave him access to potentially valuable information. But even if such a fancy had introduced himself to his mind, it does not mean it was a welcome thought or one that he relished. And even if he had been eager to undertake such an effort, he would have had no channel for it, no clearly defined plan for how to get such information into the hands of those to whom it meant something. Until he found himself across the table from his old acquaintance, who offered him a new mission and a new name, Samuel Culper Jr. I have disclosed every secret to you and laid before you every instruction that has been handed to me, Woodhull said, leaning back in his chair after the long conversation. I told you the whole business. Townsend looked at his friend skeptically. Despite their nearness in age, they had never been especially close. Both geography and temperament had kept them at a distance from each other. But everyone on Long Island, it seemed, was related to everyone else if you went back a generation or two. Townsend knew their families were connected somehow, and they trusted each other because of it. Even more important than blood ties, though, were the ideological ones. Townsend understood that Woodhull had a heart for the cause of liberty. Despite his gruff exterior, his trust in Townsend, considering him worthy of such an undertaking, was moving. Townsend looked across the table to where Woodhull watched him, his face eager for a decision. He had laid out the nature of the mission, every risk, fright, and sleepless night it had brought him, in painful detail. Townsend knew that if he agreed to join the silent fight by taking over the observations in Manhattan, it would wear him down as much as it had Woodhull. Though they were different in personality, Woodhull somewhat cantankerous and Townsend merely reserved, Townsend suspected they were quite alike in their desire to simply be left in peace. A double life would only erode whatever sense of calm he had managed to create for himself, but he also suspected that denying a chance to fight back would erode his conscience. He was frightened. Frightened of all the unthinkable possibilities if he were ever found out. Frightened that he already knew too much. Frightened of what would happen if he sat by and did nothing. Townsend reached across the table and shook Woodhull's hand. It was not without trepidation, but it was a handshake nonetheless. The two men talked into the night, discussing every eventuality, every risk, every pressing reason, why those risks didn't ultimately matter. Woodhull would soon add a senior to his codename, and Townsend could become Culper Jr. No one need ever know, nor even have means to discover, the real man behind the intelligence reports. Woodhull's earlier desire for anonymity now paled in comparison to Townsend's insistence that no one other than Woodhull and the courier, not even General Washington, should be aware of his involvement. Townsend was leery even of the courier knowing his face, but relented on the point out of necessity. Townsend did not accept the assignment with enthusiasm. However, despite his fear and reluctance, he was also Samuel Townsend's son. Though he might not share his father's fiery boldness, he was no less a man of brave conviction. With that conviction, hardened by his father's mistreatment, he was ready to join the ring. Woodhull wrote to General Washington on June 20th. My success hath exceeded my most sanguine expectations. I have communicated my business to an intimate friend. It was with great difficulty I gained his compliance, checked by fear. He is a person that hath the interests of our country at heart, and of a good reputation, character, and family as any of my acquaintance. I am under the most solemn obligation never to disclose his name to any but the post, who unavoidably must know it. I have reason to think his advantages for serving you and abilities are far superior to mine. Washington's orders. General Washington was delighted with the proposal, and together with Talmadge drafted a detailed list of guidelines and directives for his new agent in New York. The full document that follows offers an intimate perspective on Washington's philosophies regarding spying and the specific mission of Culper Jr. Instructions. Culper Jr. to remain in the city, to collect all the useful information he can. To do this, he should mix as much as possible among the officers and refugees, visit the coffee houses and all public places. He is to pay particular attention to the movements by land and water, in and about the city especially, how their transports are secured against the attempts to destroy them, whether by armed vessels upon the flanks or by chains, booms, or any contrivances to keep off fire rafts. The number of men destined for defense of the city and environs, endeavoring to designate the particular corps and where each is posted. To be particular in describing the place where the works cross the island in the rear of the city, how many redoubts are upon the line from river to river, how many cannons in each, and of what weight, and whether the redoubts are closed or open next the city. Whether there are any works upon the island of New York between those near the city and the works at Fort Niphausen or Washington, and if any, whereabouts, and of what kind. To be very particular to find out whether any works are thrown up on Harlem River near Harlem Town, or whether Horn's Hook is fortified. If so, how many men are kept at each place, and what number and what size cannons are in those works. To inquire whether they have dug pits within and in front of the lines and works in general, 3 or 4 feet deep, in which sharp-pointed stakes are fixed. These are intended to receive and wound men who attempt a surprise at night. The state of their provisions, forage, and fuel to be attended to, as also the health and spirits of the army, navy, and city. These are the principal matters to be observed within the island and about the city of New York. Many more may occur to a person of Culper Jr.'s penetration, which he will note and communicate. Culper Sr. stationed to be upon Long Island to receive and transmit the intelligence of Culper Jr. As it is imagined that the only post of consequence which the enemy will attempt to hold upon Long Island in case of attack will be at Brooklyn. I would recommend that some inhabitant in the neighborhood of that place, and seemingly in the interest of the enemy, should be procured, who might probably gain daily admission into the garrison by carrying on marketing, and from intelligence might be gained every day or two of what was passing within, as the strength of the garrison, the number and size of the cannon, etc. Proper persons to be procured at convenient distances along the Sound from Brooklyn to Newtown, whose business it shall be to observe and report what is passing upon the water, or whether any vessels or boats with troops are moving, their number, and which way they may be bound. There may be scarcely any need of recommending the greatest caution and secrecy in a business so critical and dangerous. The following seem to be the best general rules. To entrust none but the persons fixed upon to transact the business. To deliver the dispatches to none upon our side but those who shall be pitched upon for the purpose of receiving them and to transmit them and any intelligence that may be obtained to no one but the commander-in-chief. Washington thought Brooklyn was the one place on Long Island that the British would regard as indispensable, because the Culper Ring's route of conveying messages passed directly from Manhattan to Brooklyn, before continuing on to Setauken and across the Sound to Connecticut. The courier would have an excellent opportunity to observe military activity in Brooklyn and could add any relevant information to the letter he was carrying from Townsend. In short, the route seemed as close to an ideal arrangement as Washington could hope for at the time. Shopkeeper and reporter. Robert Townsend's career as a spy began in the summer of 1779. His fears of the courier knowing his identity proved largely needless. Woodhull himself, at least at first, seems to have been the primary person who retrieved Townsend's reports to begin their circuitous route to General Washington. Woodhull's name appears in the ledger of Townsend's stores several times during that season, July 18, August 15, and August 31st, and they certainly saw each other more often than that. A letter to Talmadge from Woodhull, July 9th, reveals that the pair had recently met, and in a letter to Washington dated July 15th, Townsend wrote, "I saw Samuel Culper Sr. a few days ago and informed him of the arrival of 10 sail of vessels from the West Indies with rum and etc., and a small fleet from Halifax, but no troops." In fact, Townsend's detailed reports on naval activities were far more precise than any Woodhull had been able to provide. but Townsend's difficulties with obtaining good troop counts for the Army reveal how seriously he took his work.
"I am sorry that I cannot give you an exact account of the situation of the troops," he penned on August 6th.
"You may think I have not taken sufficient pains to obtain it. I assure you that I have, and find it more difficult than I expected. It is some measure owing to my not having got into a regular line of getting intelligence. To depend upon common reports would not do. I saw and conversed with two officers of different corps from Kingsbridge, from neither of whom I could obtain an account of the situation of the Army there. I was afraid of being too particular." Townsend needed a way to move freely about the city, making inquiries and giving people a reason to trust him. In other words, he needed a cover story, and he found one just down the street in the coffee house and print shop of an English expatriate named James Rivington. A printer and a bookseller by trade, Rivington had left England in 1760 over some unpleasantness, most likely having to do with losing his share of his father's business in horse racing. Sailed to America, and opened up a printing shop first in Philadelphia and then later in New York City. In 1773, he started publishing his own newspaper as a neutral press with the tagline, "Open and Uninfluenced." But eventually he began to promote, as did so many newspapers of the era, a very specific and forceful worldview. In Rivington's case, it was loyalty to King George, a stance that got him hung in effigy by the Sons of Liberty and mocked openly in patriot writings, gestures that seemed to greatly amuse him. Townsend had always had a knack for writing. For all his natural reserve and speaking, he would be very expressive with a pen, and his meticulous detail-oriented nature that had served him well inspecting cargo ships also lent itself to composing interesting letters. Recognizing a perfect cover opportunity, he applied for a job at Rivington's paper to write the occasional column of local interest. Rivington recognized the quiet shopkeeper from down the street and was happy to take him up on his offer to contribute to the Royal Gazette's offerings. It was a stroke of brilliance on Townsend's part. He now had the perfect excuse for asking questions, jotting down details, querying various movements of troops and materiel as well, out of and around the city. What was more, Rivington's Tory politics would help deflect any suspicion that Townsend might be harboring patriotic sentiments. Townsend found himself quite busy as he adjusted to the work of three jobs: shopkeeper, journalist, and undercover agent. As a solitary man with no family, few friends to distract him, he may have found the new duties a nerve-wracking but interesting distraction. His association with Rivington likely introduced new acquaintances to his circle as well, as the in-crowd flocked to the coffee house to be seen in such esteemed company as the British officers. If Townsend's plain, dark clothes set him apart from the fashionable gentlemen and ladies who discussed politics and soirees, military strategy and dinner parties, no one seemed to mind too much. Townsend might even have caught sight of a familiar face or two among the coffee-sipping patrons. He might have spotted an old acquaintance from Oyster Bay, or the nephew of a neighbor, or member of a prominent Long Island family such as the Floyds, or perhaps even one of his own distant cousins. There was no reason for him to fear such recognitions, should they occur, however. His shop was situated just a few yards away, and had been for several years, making it completely natural for him to be found at the coffee house, making the acquaintance of all who came through. Major John Andre. Another more sinister figure was establishing himself at Rivington's coffee house at the same time as Townsend. The British had wasted no time in developing their own counter-spy network. In the spring of 1779, General Henry Clinton had appointed the dashing young Major John Andre as his chief intelligence officer. The major had impressed the general with his wit and savvy when the general arrived in Philadelphia in the early months of 1778. Now, a little over a year after they first became acquainted, Clinton entrusted Andre with the task of managing the espionage efforts in the colonies, with a specific eye on New York. Andre and Clinton were well aware that Washington was desperate to retake New York and had to be sending spies there, eager to intercept patriot agents. The new intelligence officer set up his headquarters in Manhattan. Andre was one of those individuals who thrive wherever planted. He'd always been a rather worldly man. His father was from Geneva, and his mother was from Paris, and they raised him in London, educating him with high hopes for a future in diplomacy. He was fluent in several languages, including English, French, German, and Italian, and was a gifted artist, and often composed comical verses, much to the amusement of his comrades. He was also famed as a party planner and a social coordinator, having directed and painted many of the sets for a celebratory theatrical event in honor of General Howe's return to England from Philadelphia. He had been the toast of that city during the occupation and was rumored to have offered more than just brotherly love to several ladies therein. Among those who were thought to have fancied him was Peggy Shippen, a sparkling teenager from a prominent loyalist family who was renowned as much for her graciousness as for her beauty. By the summer of 1779, Andre had moved to New York, and Shippen had recently married a widower named Benedict Arnold, a general in the Continental Army who had gotten to know her when the Americans reclaimed the city the previous year. It was an unlikely alliance given his employment and her family's politics, but one that seemed to delight bride and groom alike. Andre, for his part, considered New York a step up from Philadelphia, as it was the closest thing that America had to offer in terms of bustle and variety to his hometown of London. He quickly became a fixture on the social scene, charming all company with his gallant manners and jovial personality, and spending many languid afternoons sipping coffee and trading ideas at Rivington's shop. Andre found yet another advantage to his patronage of Rivington's establishment. He now had a willing publisher for his poems. Rivington was happy to publish any doggerel the dashing young Major Andre sent his way, as even the silly rhymes of such a popular figure were sure to sell newspapers among the loyalist set in Manhattan. So it was that the counterspy unwittingly published his poetry next to the columns of his biggest target. The Lady. It was probably through his newspaper work that Townsend first made his acquaintance of a young female socialite of whom he informed Woodhull. In his letter dated August 15, 1779, Woodhull recorded that there was a specific lady of my acquaintance, so situated as to outwit them all. Her sudden appearance in his letters following the recruitment of Townsend, as well as the fact that Townsend's ledger shows he and Woodhull met the same day, hints at the fact that she may have been introduced to the ring by Townsend himself. That she was already in Woodhull's acquaintance indicates that her name, at least, was already known to him prior to that day, perhaps indicating that she or her family were originally from Long Island. But her apparent presence in Manhattan of late meant that she was somehow uniquely positioned to collect important secrets in a cunning, charming manner that could leave those she had just duped completely unaware that they had just been outwitted by a secret agent. But just who was this mysterious woman, so perfectly poised to steal such vital secrets? Woodhull was careful not to record her name, offering only a number, 355, in the code that was to define the Culper ring. Chapter 7, Creating a Code. Even as Robert Townsend was settling into his new role, something happened that highlighted the precarious nature of the world in which he now lived. On July 2, 1779, British raiders had attacked Major Talmadge's camp at dawn, killing 10 men, capturing 8, plus a dozen horses. Those losses were devastating, but in the aftermath, Talmadge made a discovery that proved unsettling and was potentially threatening to the Patriots' intelligence operations. One of the horses the British had stolen was his own, which still bore its saddlebags and some of Talmadge's personal papers, including some money earmarked for Woodhull and a letter from Washington that specifically named George Higday, a resident of Manhattan, who I am told hath given signal proofs of his attachment to us, and at the same time stands well with the enemy. 11 days later, Higday was arrested at his home and confessed to having met with George Washington to discuss the possibility of spying, but claimed that he never carried out any such activity because the payment had been in fake bills. There being no record of any punishment carried out against Higday, he was probably deemed harmless and sufficiently terrified not to be tempted into any covert actions in the future, so the matter was dropped. But Washington had seen the dangers of using real names in correspondence and again felt the weight of the responsibility he had to guard the lives of those risking themselves for their shared cause. Beyond Higday's fate, there was another, even more immediate concern to the Culpers. On June 13th, Washington had written to Talmadge in regular ink and mentioned having a particular special liquid. What was further, he referred to C-blank-R, a common form of address for the day, when a name was well known between two correspondents. The letter was intercepted and landed in the hands of the British prior to the July 2nd raid, alerting them to the definite presence of an American spy in New York, one
with whom Talmadge was in close contact. The British had no way of knowing if C-blank-R was a code name or a proper one, but they didn't care. They were after bigger fish than just a spy. They wanted the spymaster himself, and the seized letter pointed straight to his camp. Though Talmadge had been fortunate enough to escape capture, he knew the damage had been done. If the ring were to survive, the spies would have to disguise information to protect it from prying eyes, while keeping it understandable to those who depended upon the contents of the letters. Alarmed by the two close calls, Talmadge turned to the development of a code with a new sense of urgency. The ring had already begun to use a few numerical substitutions in their letters. For example, 10 stood for New York, and 20 for Setauket, so that the recipient could know the source of the information contained in the reports. Two additional numbers, 30 and 40, were used to designate Jonas Hawkins and Austin Rowe as post riders delivering the messages to their next destination. Talmadge realized how essential it was that a more complete lexicon be developed and that every member or associate of the ring have a number rather than just a code name. In a style of cryptography developed originally by the French, Talmadge selected a book and got to work. Making a list from 1 to 763, he pored over his copy of Entick's Spelling Dictionary, the 1777 London edition, and assigned each pertinent word, location, or name a numeric code. He became 721. Woodhull, as Culper Sr., 722. Townsend, Culper Jr., 723. Rowe, 724. And Brewster, 725. General Washington was 711. And his British counterpart, General Clinton, was 712. Numbers were represented by letters so that the year 1779, for example, would read as ENNQ. If a word needed to be plural or put in the past or future tense, a flourish would be written on top of it to designate the change. The new system was not foolproof and required some adjustments on the part of the users, but Woodhull and Talmadge were able to use it to correspond comfortably within a few weeks, though with a lingering sense of concern for what damage had been done by the intercepted message in June. In his same letter that mentioned the lady of my acquaintance, Woodhull opened 729-29-15-1779. Sir, DQPEU, BEYOCPU, agreeable to 28, met 723 not far from 727, and received a 356, but on his return was under the necessity to destroy the same, or be detected. There's been no augmentation by 592 of 680, or 347 forces, and everything very quiet. Every 356 is opened at the entrance of 727, and every 371 is searched. That for the future, every 356 must be 691, with the 286 received. They have some 345 at the route our 356 takes. I judge it was mentioned in the 356 taken, or they would not be so 660. You see how complicated it could be? Translated, with the few creative grammatical adjustments required by the reader, the letter conveyed the following message. Setauket, August 15, 1779. Sir Jonas Hawkins, agreeable to appointment, met Culper Jr. not far from New York and received a letter, but on his return was under the necessity to destroy the same or be detected. There's been no augmentation by ship, of war, or land forces, and everything was very quiet. Every letter is opened at the entrance of New York, and every man is searched. That for the future every letter must be write or written with the ink received. They have some know or knowledge of the route our letters take. I judge it was mentioned in the letter taken, or they would not be so vigilant. Agent 355. Talmadge's code contained a quirk that both reflects its time and offers up clues to a mystery. There are different codes to designate man, 371, and gentleman, 237, and woman, 701, and lady, 355. Thus, there was a kind of commentary upon the social situation of a subject embedded within the code itself. Any mature adult might be referred to with the generic term man or woman according to the subject's sex. However, a gentleman in the American colonies was nearly always considered a man who owned land or considerable amount of property and was respected as a person of character in his local community. A woman might be referred to as a lady if she was of a well-to-do family or was an accomplished young woman, that is, either literate and educated or proficient in the arts of domestic leisure, such as music, painting, and needlework. In other words, a man or a woman would generally only be referred to as a gentleman or a lady if he or she were of certain means and social standing. Social standing directly affected the intelligence a person could acquire. A washerwoman or a coachman may be in a position to overhear some kinds of private conversation, whereas an established gentleman or lady may be introduced to different types of gossip in a dining room. So Talmadge's differentiation was strategic. In the case of 355, the lady of the Culper acquaintance, her code indicates that she was of some degree of social prominence. Was she Anna Smith Strong, the wife of Judge Zella Strong, a fierce patriot who was first detained on a British prison ship in New York Harbor, then fled to Connecticut after his release? Local legend has it that Mrs. Strong, who remained behind to manage the house and family when her husband went into exile, used to hang laundry in specific patterns on her line. The Strong estate, situated on a high bluff, would be visible to anyone passing by boat across the Devil's Belt portion of Long Island Sound. The hanging clothes would appear as just that, wet clothes drying in the sun, to the untrained eye, that is. But to Caleb Brewster, the arrangement of garments and their colors signified different counts of ships and troops, or in which cove it was safe for him to dock his boat, depending on which version of the story one hears. He would then be able to compile the information and pass it on with the Culper letters from New York when he rode back across the water to meet Talmadge or his courier in Connecticut. While Anna Smith Strong might have played a satellite role in the ring, she was certainly an acquaintance of many of its members, assisting Woodhull, Rowe, or Brewster at some point. There is no actual evidence that either she or her laundry ever served their country by gathering or passing along intelligence. It seems quite unlikely that the 40-ish housewife, mother, and spouse of a well-known patriot rabble-rouser would have ventured from Long Island to Manhattan to attend parties where she would have rubbed elbows with the loyalist elite and gained the trust of high-ranking British officers. A much more likely contender would be a young woman living a fashionable life in New York. Though of pro-American sentiments herself, she almost certainly would have been attached to a prominent loyalist family, either as a free-thinking daughter or a cousin or a niece who is staying in the city with her Tory relations. It is therefore possible that 355 was part of the glittering, giggling cluster of coquettes who flocked around Major Andre as he moved around the city, enjoying the finest food, wine, and company New York had to offer. Some of New York's brighter blooms were demure and others played coy, but just as had been the case in Philadelphia, a few found themselves admitted into Andre's private chambers and his confidence, too. Beyond letters. Despite the white ink and the coded communication, Washington knew that the British were growing more suspicious of the mail and that the tiniest details could attract scrutiny. Writing from his headquarters at West Point, New York, Washington sent Talmadge a letter advising the major on this matter and also suggested that Townsend not sacrifice his current employment in order to operate as a full-time spy. His cover story, as it stood, protected far better and allowed him more freedom to gather information that he would have if he focused solely on intelligence gathering. The following letter reveals much of George Washington's thought process concerning espionage, especially in regard to protecting his valued source. Headquarters, West Point, 24 September, 1779. Sir, it is not my opinion that Culper Jr. should be advised to give up his present employment. I would imagine that with a little industry, he would be able to carry on his intelligence with greater security to himself and greater advantages to us, under cover of his usual business, than if he were able to dedicate himself wholly to the giving of information. It may afford him opportunities of collecting intelligence that he would not obtain so well in any other manner. It prevents also those suspicions which would become natural should he throw himself out of the line of his present employment. He may rest assured of every proper attention being paid to his services. One thing appears to be deserving of his particular consideration, as if it will not only render his communications less exposed to detection, but relieve the fears of such persons as may be entrusted with his conveyance to the second link in the chain, and of course very much facilitate the object we have in view. I mean that he should occasionally write his information on the blank leaves of a pamphlet on the first, second, and other pages of a common pocketbook, or on the blank leaves at each end of registers, almanacs, or any new publication, or book of small value. He should be determined in the choice of these books principally by the goodness of the blank paper, as the ink is not easily legible unless it is on paper of a good quality. Having settled a plan of his kind with his friend, he may forward them without risk of search or the scrutiny of the enemy, as this is chiefly directed against paper made up in the form of letters. I would add a further hint on this subject. Even letters may be more subservient to the communication than they have yet been. He may write a familiar letter on domestic affairs or on some little matters of business to his friend at Setauket or elsewhere, interlining with the stain his secret intelligence or writing it on the opposite blank side of the letter. But that his friend may know how to distinguish these from letters addressed solely to himself, he may always leave such as contain secret information without date or place, dating it with the stain, or fold them up in a particular manner, which may be concerted between the parties. This last appears to be the best mark of the two, and may be the signal of their being designated for me. The first mentioned mode, however, or that of the books, appears to me the one least liable to detection. I am, etc. Washington, it seems, was an advocate of the practice of hiding messages in plain view. If a letter appeared suspicious or was treated with the utmost caution and concern, it was more likely to tip off British inspectors. By instead passing along the highly sensitive information disguised as dull letters on day-to-day family news or hidden in a book, the vehicle by which the message was being sent would probably not warrant a second glance. Only the intended recipient would know, tipped off by an otherwise meaningless clue such as a specific fold, that there was anything more to the item than met the eye. With Rivington's print shop operating just down the street, and as someone who enjoyed an established relationship with the owner, Townsend had no shortage of books available for sending messages the way Washington had put forward. But Townsend, using his invisible ink, seems to have preferred an alternative means of his own design. When the courier, usually Woodhull or Rowe, judging from his store's ledger, arrived to pick up the goods he had purchased to bring back to Long Island, among them would be a packet of blank writing paper. Concealed within those loose leaves was a seemingly blank sheet, which contained the invisible letter to be rendered readable once it reached a destination and the stain was applied. Clear communication as to how many sheets into the stack the significant paper would be placed was essential to avoid wasting precious stain in an attempt to discern which sheet contained the message. But all in all, it worked extremely well as an innocuous way to smuggle reports out of the city. With these new security measures in place, and Culper Jr. and 355 firmly established in their roles in New York, the Ring could now begin to forward intelligence more swiftly, safely, and in greater detail than before, though the risk of detection and capture remained. The life of a spy would always require looking over one's shoulder, but now Washington's operatives could enjoy at least a little more freedom to speak about their observances and advisements without needing to censor their words in case a letter fell into the wrong hands. The added security was just in time, too. With Andre's arrival in the city, there were plots afoot, plans of deceit, treason, and betrayal, and the only hope that Americans had to survive them was to be prepared. Washington knew that New York City was of utmost strategic importance from a military perspective, but even he could not anticipate how crucial the intelligence collected there would be in saving the cause for liberty. And neither side, American nor British, could yet imagine just how deep the treachery reached within its own ranks. Chapter 8. Mounting Tensions and Double Dealings. Suspicions and tensions were beginning to rise even as the summer of 1779 reached its peak, and all the agents were feeling the stress. Washington sent all the white ink I now have, indeed all that there is any prospect of getting soon, with a trusted colonel, along with the desperate instructions. You will send these to Culper Jr. as soon as possible, and I beg that no mention may ever be made of your having received such liquids from me or anyone else. In all cases, and at all times, this procedure and circumspection is necessary. But it is indispensably so now, as I am informed that Governor Tryon, British Governor of New York, has a preparation of the same acid or something similar to it, which may lead to a detection if it is ever known that a matter of this sort has passed from me. Just 4 days later, Townsend prepared another letter for General Washington, closing with several lines that pointed to the increased danger he was also observing. "The times now are extremely difficult," he wrote. "Guard boats are kept out every night in the North and East Rivers to prevent any boats from passing, and I am informed that some persons have been searched on Long Island. Therefore, whenever you think that my intelligence is of no service, beg you will notify me." Indeed, letters were now being searched with regularity as they left the city. Jonas Hawkins, the Ring Sometimes courier, twice believed he was in danger of being found out and destroyed the missives he was carrying from Townsend, much to the older man's annoyance. On September 11, 1779, Woodhull acted as a courier in place of Hawkins and wrote to explain what had happened to the letters from Culper Jr. that had never made it to Washington as a result of Hawkins' fear. "The bearer thought himself in danger. I believe it was merely imaginary," Woodhull penned. "From timidity and the situation of affairs at the time, he did choose to come to New York. I therefore met him at a place quite out of danger on Long Island. I then made an appointment, at which time he came, I wrote it, took it over the ferry, that he might run no hazard from the inspector of letters there." Townsend had never felt confident in Hawkins, having resented that his identity necessarily should be known by a boy he considered too immature for such serious work. For all of Townsend's natural reserve, his reaction was almost certainly far from calm. "He should never have been entrusted with such a task," Townsend stormed to Woodhull, when he learned of the destruction of his second letter. "We needed another courier," Woodhull tried to explain. "But why am I risking my life, gathering information day after day, if my letters are to be destroyed before they reach the general?" Woodhull shook his head. The boy simply panicked. But one who panics, or even looks nervous, before the inspectors is bound to bring extra scrutiny upon himself. And if he is searched, and anything suspicious is found upon him, where will be the first place the British turn? He paused, looking to Woodhull for an answer. But Woodhull just scraped at a bit of candle wax on the table. "They'll look to any of his known associates, and to the last place he did business, which, inevitably, will bring them to my shop," Townsend finished flatly. "We are, all of us, on edge," Woodhull said quietly. "And we are, all of us, endangered by that boy's want of good sense and composure." Townsend banged his fist upon the table with such force it caused the candles to jump. "I cannot always be coming here to retrieve your information myself. That will raise suspicions too," Woodhull insisted. "Besides, General Washington desires the information even more quickly than we have been supplying it. If you wait until I'm able to make the trip, it will only delay the relay of news." "Then we get another man," Townsend said, sighing and sinking into the straight-backed chair. "This time, one who knows how to keep his wits about him. But you were the one who insisted that your identity not be disclosed to anyone else. So what are we to do?" Townsend dropped his head into his hands. The two friends discussed several scenarios, weighing the risks and benefits of each. Finally, the name Amos Underhill came up, Woodhull's brother-in-law and the proprietor of a boarding house where Woodhull stayed on his frequent trips to Manhattan. "He needs provisions as much as anyone else. Why could he not frequent my shop for goods and pick up the reports at the same time?" Townsend mused. Woodhull considered this. "I'd have to travel into the city to retrieve them, unless Amos could be convinced to come across the water sometimes. But it would lessen your visits to my shop and give us fewer opportunities to be spotted together. And he need not know the exact nature of our business together unless you deem it absolutely necessary." "It's a gloomy thing to toast on," Woodhull remarked, "but I agree that it's a far better thing than to have young Hawkins destroy any more of your letters, or, worse, be driven to madness and confess all. Give me a bit of time to present the matter to Amos and make proper arrangements. Until then, I will continue to serve as a courier." One can hardly blame Hawkins for his trepidation. The threats were growing, and the whole Culper Ring felt the squeeze. The pressure continued to mount as autumn approached. Besides fearing British searches, the couriers also faced dangers from increasingly active privateers. In his letter dated November 1, 1779, Talmadge wrote to General Washington of the growing hazards faced by the members of the ring, including the once fearless Caleb Brewster. "The boat that crosses for dispatches from Culper has been chased quite across the Sound by those plunderers, perhaps for the sake of being the more secret in their villainy, while our crew has suspected them to be the enemy. Indeed, if some stop cannot be made to such nefarious practices, Culper will not risk, nor 725, Brewster, go over for dispatches." By the end of November, Amos Underhill's name began to appear regularly in Townsend's ledger. Hawkins, meanwhile, seems to also have questioned his involvement and quietly removed himself from the ring. Underhill's appearance could not have been better timed, as Woodhull's nerves were again getting the best of him. Woodhull had been questioned by a party of British troops while en route to meet with Townsend at a safe house on Long Island, but apparently kept his wits about him because he was released without having to succumb to a more thorough search. Townsend, however, did not show. Woodhull waited at the rendezvous point the next day as well, but there was no sign of Culper Jr. The excuse for his absence does not appear in any of Townsend's letters. But as he was quite condemning in his correspondence of others who failed to make appointments, it was undoubtedly a serious matter, beyond simply a lack of courage. The slip brought Woodhull nearly to a breaking point, prompting him to tell Talmadge afterward that he had endured a full year's anxiety, which no one scarcely had an idea of but those that experience. Not long since, there was not even the breath of your finger betwixt me and death. Woodhull's complaint was not unwarranted. The residents of Long Island were bracing for an even greater number of troops to be quartered there during the coming winter than they endured the winter before. They also continued to absorb loyalist refugees from all over the eastern seaboard. The inhabitants of this island at present live a miserable life, which you may readily judge when having the refuse of 3 kingdoms and 13 states amongst them. Plundering and rapine increaseth at no small rate, Woodhull wrote in the same letter to Talmadge. I'm tired of this business. It gives me a deal of trouble, especially when disappointments happen. Could not consent to be any longer an assistant if I was not almost an enthusiast for our success. But there was a covert storm brewing in New York, one that Townsend was in the process of uncovering and confirming, that threatened the Americans not through bloodshed or siege, but through their pocketbooks. And if it was on account of uncovering this business that Townsend was unable to meet with Woodhull, he might very well be excused by reason of the magnitude of the plot he thwarted. Striking a mint. The British were highly skilled counterfeiters, and one of their favorite ways to attack the Americans was by depreciating colonial currency. At the most basic level, a worthless currency made it difficult for the Continental Army to purchase rations, rendering the soldiers' pay, quite literally, not worth the paper it was printed on. On a grander scale, having a wildly inflated currency made it nearly impossible for American diplomats overseas to secure credit with foreign banks, a severe problem in both the short and long terms. Without financial backing, the Americans could not bankroll the food, men, horses, warships, and weapons needed to win the revolution. If, against all odds, they were successful in their split from the British crown, the new nation could need credit to rebuild its infrastructure, a concern the British did not have to contend with because the war was an ocean away from London. Recognizing the vulnerability of the American currency, the British ran counterfeiting operations aboard British ships and on shore where possible. Distribution of counterfeit bills was an open secret in the early years of the war, with advertisements even running in newspapers for travelers headed to other colonies to carry with them fake bills of their current location to their new destination. Aware of the danger, Woodhull himself even insisted on being paid in the king's currency, a request Washington honored without question. The Continental Congress had made efforts to combat the counterfeiting, but saw limited success. Eventually, they developed a special paper of a very precise quality and thickness that would be used to produce the bulk of the money minted in Philadelphia, and, it was hoped, would be extremely difficult to replicate. This would allow the government much greater control as to the amount in circulation, which would, in turn, control inflation. What Townsend learned, however, and wrote about with urgency to Washington on November 27, 1779, was that several reams of paper made for the last emission struck by Congress have been procured from Philadelphia. The one safeguard upon which the Americans were counting to protect the currency had been breached. Somehow, whether through negligence or a double agent, the paper and possibly even the printer plates had made their way into New York, where the British could use them to turn out perfect counterfeits. Distribution in New York would drive down prices and sink the economy of the colonies right in the heart of their main